Okay, today is February the 19th, 1995, and my name is Rick Bradley, and I'm back once again in Pittsburgh, Kansas, with my old friend, Don Gutteridge. Don, tell me about the story, the Lonnie Warnke story of him in the electric chair.
Oh, that's quite a story, too. Well, Warnke and I were roommates, and of course we had a lot of fun. He was a kind of a jokester, too. But we were roommate on the Cardinals, and one time we were up in Boston and we had an off day and we were walking down the street and we saw this secondhand bookstore. We just went in and just moseying around, and he found this book, A Thousand Years at Sing Sing by Warden Laws. And he said, I think I'll take that. So he took it. He was reading it that evening. We sitting there, and after dinner, we're sitting there reading, and he read, and he said, you know what, I think I'll just call Warden Law. I'd like to go through that same thing. That's an interesting book. I said, well, why? I was kind of agitated a little bit. I said, well, why don't you call him up and let him talk about it? He said, well, I think I will. So, lo and behold, he did, you know, knowing him. You have to know him. He just picked up the phone and got long distance and called Warden Law, and Warden Law answered the phone. And he said, we're the Cardinals, and we'd like to come see Sing Sing. We've read your book, and, well, yeah, when would you like to come? And Warnke said, well, we've got an off day between Boston and New York, I think on a Tuesday or Wednesday, anyway, a couple of days later. And he said, well, how are you coming down? I said, well, we come down on a train. He said, I'll see what I can do if I can get that conductor to stop that train. So lo and behold, he called back pretty soon and said, yeah. He said, now, how many are you going to bring with you? All of you? Oh, Warnke said, no, I will bring all of them. We'll bring several little players. And I think Jimmy Brown and a few, and myself, and Warnke, and a couple more pitchers. We just a bunch of us are going to get off. Excuse me. Lo and behold, we got on the train, stopped down, and they stopped out there, and we jumped off because it wasn't a scheduled stop. We had to be ready. We jumped off, and Warden Law, he met us with a bus and took us over in the Sing Sing over there in Austin, New York. And I tell you, I got a little scary when the bus drove through the gate and that big clang went down behind you. I thought, hey, we're shut off here, boy. But it was a great day. We got there about 10 o'clock in the morning, and he declared everything opened that day, so everybody, all the prisoners were free to go anywhere they wanted to go, except the death row, of course. And the prisoners didn't want to go there anyway. But anyway, we had lunch with them, we talked with them, we played catch with them, we just, you know, went. A lot of them wanted us to see their cells and how they fixed them up. It was really a nice day. And so finally, they were leading us around, and he said, "Would you like to see the electric chair?" Yeah, we'd like to see that electric chair. So, of course, we did. He said, okay, but that's when the prisoners all left us. I'll tell you, we were by ourselves then. And we went in there, and Warnke was in there. That's good. And he was examining the electric chair, and it was sitting there. And Warnke said, hey, why don't you go sit in that chair? Of course, I'm the gullible one. You know, he and I was always doing something. He said, go sit down in the electric chair. And I said, oh, not me. He said, oh, go sit down in the electric chair. Let's see how you look in there or something. He said, and so I did. I, old smart aleck me, I went down there, you know, I was frisky and young and innocent. And I sat down in the electric chair, and I didn't notice that he was edging over towards the door where the light switch was. And so I sat in that chair, you know, and got all set in that chair, and all it was, he ripped over and he flipped that chair, flipped that light a couple of times, the light went off and off, and I'd come right out there. I thought I was really in the electric chair. he was a lot of fun.
Was there a band called the Mudcat Band?
Oh, yes, the Mudcat Band. Pepper Martin, Bob Weiland, left-hand pitcher, Frenchie Bordigeray, and Bill McGee, who was a pitcher, and he played the fiddle left-handed. And I think Max Lanier was in on it too, I'm not sure, the way I remember it. And they had a band, and Pepper and Warnke played the banjos, and guitars or whatever you call them. And Bob wound up blue in a jug. And Frenchie Boy the Great played the old washboard, you know, like the old washboard with a ring on his ring. And they played, they was going to entertain. They played old songs. And it was quite, they quite entertaining. You know, they'd go somewhere, well, they'd get out the band, they'd love to play. People listened to them because they were ball players, not because they could play. And one time, Frankie Priest said, "Who announces your program?" And he said, "Well, I do." He said, "Well, I don't think you need an announcer." He said, "They all the tunes sound the same anyway." And they played. They had quite a band. They even got little uniforms for themselves. And I think after the season was over, I think they played in the theater there at time or two. But it was Mudcat Band, and it was a horrible band, but they had more fun than anybody else.
Tell me about Frenchie Bordigeret. This guy was he ignored signs.
Frenchie
ran when he wanted.
Frenchie just he was Frenchie Bordigeret. I guess that's the best way you can put it, because he just had a good time. He wasn't exactly, he just did about what he wanted to do. And one time they tell me the story that I heard, I didn't know it, but he was playing for Brooklyn at one time, and he was on second base, and he'd hit a double, and he was standing there at second base, and Casey Stengel was coaching third base. He was the manager at that time, and so he was standing there talking to the second baseman. They threw the ball, and Casey thought he was standing on the base. And so he turned around and they threw the ball back to the second baseman. Second baseman tagged him, and the umpire called him out. Well, Casey had a fit. He was standing on second base. Portuguese said, no, I wasn't standing on. He said, I was about this far from it.
He was honest anyway.
He was honest. Frenchie was really, he and Pepper pulled all kinds of things. I mean, they had a lot of fun. Along, of course, with Dizzy and Paul. And Dizzy and Paul, Dizzy and Paul and Pepper, and that was a crew that you could probably write. Well, they have written books about them already. But I never will forget one time when I first joined the club, and I was really new. And I just, rookie, of course, I followed them around like a little puppy dog. So anyway, they were up in the hotel in Philadelphia one day. And so they were walking down the hall, Pepper were walking down the hall, and lo and behold, they saw the painters. There was a bunch of painters there, and they'd taken off their unit, they'd taken off their little overalls and put them in there. And Pepper said, "Hey, let's put them on and have some fun." So they put on these old white overalls with paint on them, and they got a couple of ladders. And there was a big meeting in the hotel. It's a very swanky hotel in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And I think that, if I'm not mistaken, I think they had a Kiwanis meeting or something. Anyway, a bunch of men in there eating. And they put these ladders on their shoulders and marched in through there. And they said, "Well, we've got to paint this wall. We've got to paint these buildings, this wall." And they set this ladders down in the middle and climbed up over those guys and act like they were going to paint the wall. Boy, those people, the waiters and the waiter, Maitre d', they was having fit. They was screaming, "Crud, get out of don't it!" Come to find out that that's who they were. I mean, they had really disrupted that meeting in a hurry. And come to find out that Ranch Rickey was in the crowd. He was supposed to speak that day or something, I guess. They of course they had a big time here, but they threatened to put him in jail and everything else. But that's the kind of thing they always did.
When Frenchie was playing, did he have a mustache?
Yes, Frenchie had a mustache.
And was he the only ball player?
He was the only ball player that I think I remember that had a mustache. And he did that just because he wanted to be different. Mm-hmm. You know, and Frenchie was different.
You mentioned Branch Rickey, and of course he was with the Cardinals Cardinals. Yeah. Talk about him for a while, especially trying to negotiate your contract from year to year.
Boy, that was a major operation trying to negotiate. You didn't negotiate with him. He negotiated with you. But when I first came to Cardinals, in fact, he bought me when I was with Lincoln, Nebraska. He bought my contract. And then, of course, I tried to negotiate with him a few times about contract. But you'd go in and he'd always one step ahead of you. Always one step ahead of you. If you wanted to tell him how good you was, or I mean some of your statistics, he'd always have something to offset that. And he was a tough negotiator. They said, and I guess this is right, and I read several stories where I thought it was, well, they said it was right, but Rance Rickey, they gave him so much money to sign all the ball players, and all he saved out of it was his. So he didn't give the ball players anything, so he'd have more at the end. Which is pretty smart, and he just negotiated. He'd make you feel like that you ought to pay him to get the play. He was a tough negotiator. He was really tough, I'll tell you.
What'd you think of him personally?
Well, personally, he was a very nice man. Of course, he was very well. In fact, I think at one time his father was a preacher. He wanted to be a preacher, and he was a very And he didn't come to the ballpark on Sundays because he promised his mother he would not play ball on Sundays. But in St. Louis, there was a YMCA building just back of center field fence, just across the street. They all accused him of going up there and watching the ball game from there and counting how many people were in the stands so he'd know how much money he's making.
What'd you think of his general managing skills?
Oh, he was a mastermind. He really was. He knew talent. He could really, for his talent, he really knew what talent. He could look at a raw rookie and could project what that rookie would probably do. And he really was excellent in that. And of course, I didn't play for him when he was manager. He managed some years before I ever started playing. But as a general manager, he was great. And he made the Cardinal organization. He really built it. He put the foundation of that. And this farm system that he started, and then that went all through baseball. And as soon as he got that, you know, everybody else started a farm club then. And what he would do, in order to make money for the Cardinals, which didn't have a very big franchise, very much marketing area, he would get these players up and let them play until they became stars. And about the time it was just going on and down, he would sell them for a big price and pay for the operation. He did that because he had somebody else coming out behind him. And he'd just send a star out and bring another rookie up. And this rookie he knew would produce. So he did produce. That's why they became a great organization.
I don't know, anybody could sell Dizzy Dean for whatever he sold.
130,
Dean for.
Well, at that time.
Yeah, to the Cubs.
Cubs, $135,000 plus four players or something like that. Wasn't it something? I remember when they made, I was there when they made the deal.
Yeah.
I mean, I was playing on the club when they made the deal, but I don't remember. But I thought it was fantastic then. And everybody knew that Dizzy Dean was had a sore arm, he couldn't pitch. We saw that in spring training because we'd all. In spring training out here, we was all talking to one another about, gee, Dizzy can't throw at all. He's really, his arm is really gone. Well, he didn't, he got over there and he proved it. He didn't.
Yeah.
He couldn't.
Yeah, because Dizzy had, he had complained a few times previous that his arm was bad when it really wasn't. He had cried wolf so many times.
Just like the little boy that cried wolf was right. And he said, oh, my arm's sore. But we saw that Dizzy actually could. We could, when we were with him and he'd seen him, we knew actually he could not pitch anymore. I mean, like he used to. He could pitch with his head a little bit, but he couldn't get by all the time with that.
You talked about Pepper Martin, and I know that, I remember you told me the story about it was the game of the century when you got hit in the eye and he went over and challenged the entire Giant dugout, but he was, you told me, I think, when you came up to the club that he kind of looked out for you?
Yes, he looked after me good because see, I was a third baseman, and he was playing third base. And he hated to play third base. He hated to play there. He couldn't play there. He said, I can't play there. They said that he used to get in front of the ball and let it hit him on the chest, and he pick up the ball after he hit the ground and throw that out. And that was it. That was it. He couldn't. He didn't like ground balls. He couldn't field. He loved to play outfield. So when I went up there and I was supposed to be the coming third baseman for him, he told everybody, say, leave this kid alone. Don't you bother him, because he would get after me. He took me under his wing. He wouldn't let anybody correct me. He wouldn't let anybody do anything that I thought would mess me up a little bit. And so I would become a third baseman so he could play outfield. And I became, as a consequence, of course, I always admired him anyway. I even before I started playing professional ball, I admired him. I saw Pepper, and we went from here, and I was just in high school, and just graduated from high school, and a friend of mine and my brother, and he said they were going to play the 1931 World Series in St. Louis against the Philadelphia Athletics. And this guy said, hey, you got an old Ford, said, I'll buy the gasoline, and let's go to St. Louis and see the World Series. So I accosted my parents, and they said, yeah, of course, Dad always let me do what I want to do anyway. And he said, yeah, get on up there. So we took out one evening about 6 o'clock and got up there about 4 o'clock in the morning and got in line to see Pepper Martin play against the Philadelphia Athletics. I never will forget the first day. We were out there, and we, of course, the people, you know, they was been out there all night, and they was kind of on edge, and they didn't care what they did. And they were, going back a little bit, and they were selling souvenirs, and one of the souvenirs was just a red pepper with a little red ribbon on it, mm-hmm. and a pin. And he bought it at the Pepper Martin. That was because he was Pepper Martin. So I bought one of them for 50 cents, I remember, and I pinned it on it because I was a Pepper Martin fan. And anyway, they opened up the gate about 8 o'clock, and at 8:15, all the bleachers were sold. And we sat there in the hot sun until about 1 o'clock when they started the ball game. Boy, the people out there was throwing hot dogs, they throw at one another, you know, clear across the thing. It was a mess out there. It was almost a battleground. But we saw Pepper Martin, and that's the year that he stole, I think, 12 bases and got 12 hits or something like that. Anyway, it was a great, great year for him. And he, because he stole so many bases on Mickey Cochran, it was the whole world. From that story on, I became Pepper Martin fan. And then when I went to the club, I was awed by him anyway. Mm-hmm. Even walking the clubhouse, even seeing Pepper Martin, it just awed me. You know, I was just a little boy with a big country boy with big eyes. Mm-hmm. So he said, hey, we'll take care of you. You be the third baseman, I can play outfield. And that's what happened. I became their third baseman, and he could play out.
Did you ever tell him that story about going to see him 3 years before?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I've seen him. I told him. Because he and his wife became good friends with my wife and I. We eventually became good friends. In fact, we're still.
His wife is still alive.
Yes, she still lives out in McAllister, Oklahoma. I know at one time in 1940, I was to... Billy Southworth came in to manage the Cardinals, and he saw that he didn't think that I was going to be, I wasn't the player that he wanted to play third base, to put it that way. And so they sent me out to Sacramento, and I said, no, I'm not going to go. If I can't play in the major leagues, I know I can play in the major leagues. If I can't play in the major leagues, I'm going to quit. I'll do something else. Mm-hmm. Well, Pepper Martin, then, that year, Pepper Martin, they named Pepper Martin manager of Sacramento in the Pacific Coast League, because the Cardinals owned that club out at that time. So he came by, he called me and he said, I want to come by and see you. So he and Ruby, his wife, came up to visit us. They stayed a couple of days with us. He said, I'll tell you what I want you to do. If you'll just go out there with me and you help me there, you'll be my, they can't hire coaches, but that you'll be my captain and help me out. And he said, if it's just 1 year, because that's my first year managing and I need help. Okay, I said, well, so we decided, well, we'd go out there with Ruby and Johnny, we called him Johnny. And we went out there and with him and I had a very good year, and it turned out that they sold me back to the St. Louis Browns. So I really got back in the major leagues. If it hadn't been for Pepper getting me out there, I probably would not have come back in the major leagues.
Was he the most hustling ball player you ever saw?
Oh, he played hard all the time. He played hard. He was rough. I mean, he was just a strong character. You know, he slid head first. He tried to get me to slide head first. Excuse me. Slide head first. He said, "Then you won't hurt yourself." So I, of course, when Pepper said so, that was, it's kind of law as far as I was concerned, because I love Pepper, and whatever he said, that was it. So I never will forget one time I slid head on third base. I was on third base one time, and he taught me, he'd come slide, I'd slide head first some of the time. And I remember Jimmy Wilson was a catcher for the old Philadelphia Phillies at that time. And I was on third base, and was fly ball hit, and I was going to score. And I rolled in, I dove in head first to slide, and Jimmy Wilson just put his, just kneeled down and let in front of the plate with those chin guards on. And I hit the head on that chin guard, and he just had the ball in his hand, and I just let it like that, and he just hit me on the top of the head, boom, like that, just real hard. He said, "Now next time, son, don't slide head first into me." So I didn't slide head first much more after that. But he did. Pepper was great. He pulled some really good stuff. Never forget one time he and Dizzy was always pulling jokes on one another. They was playing around. And so he, one time he came into the clubhouse and he got a big nail, come in with a nail and a hammer. Of course, at that time, those old clubhouses had wooden floors in them, and the lockers were just no wooden box-like thing. They weren't modern like they are now. So he had his hammer and nail, and he took Dizzy's shoes, and he put a nail right down through the instep and nailed them right on down to the floor. So Dizzy came in, and he started to pick up his shoes, and he couldn't. I like to tore his shoes apart trying to get him, you know, nail out there. So that was all right. They laughed big. Next day, Dizzy came in with a tax hammer, and Pepper had several letters there. And so he just took a tax and just tacked those letters all over. Tacked all over. So he couldn't pull them up. You'd tear up the letter. He couldn't read the letter.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what they did. They play tricks on one another, but they love one another greatly. And another thing, too, that talked about Dizzy and Pepper, when Dizzy was sold to the Chicago Cubs, and we went up there to play finally, of course, that was the big thing. Dizzy's going to pitch against his old teammates, and Pepper told Frankie Frisch he was sick, he didn't want to play. And he said, "Frankie, I don't want to play, I'm sick." Frank knew what it was, he said. He just didn't want to play against Dizzy.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "You got to play, Dizzy, you're in the lineup." And he said, "Frankie, I'm not hit a ball there and kill old Dizzy, because he just can't throw hard enough. I'm liable to hurt him if I hit that ball back through the box." Going back a little bit, Pepper always did hit a lot of balls back through the box. I mean, that was his. And he knew he'd hit a lot of balls back through there. So sure enough, they got up, and he came to bat. First time he came to bat, he hit a line drive and right back at Dizzy, and he hit Dizzy right in the belly. And in place of running to first base, he went out, "Hey, Dizzy, you hurt. So that was quite a thing. And I laughed. I said, "And Frisch just eat him up. Frisch eat him up." He said, "Well, but I didn't want to hurt old Dizzy. This is my buddy." So that was a true story, too. I was there.
Well, what was it like for you to bat against Diz when he was playing with the Cubs?
It really,
especially in the shape that he was in.
It took some of the glamour out, because I knew he'd been pitching, and I felt like it. Well, we all felt like we could hit him.
Yeah.
You know, we knew that he couldn't throw hard anymore. He used to throw hard, and besides that, he'd knock you down. You know, but we didn't get well. We got a big kick out of beating him, because he was that, you know, that this competition, you know. But no, I didn't. We didn't think a whole lot about hitting against him. He is uh, he wasn't, but he had a lot of nerve. He had a lot. He remember that year. That year, they played. They Cubs got the World Series and played against the New York
Yankees. So. Yeah.
Yankees. That's right. Yeah. And then of course you heard that story. That he pitched his heart out for that, but he just didn't have quite enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me throw another name. Oh. Let's talk about Joe Medwick.
Oh, Joe?
Was he a real bad ball hitter?
Oh, he was a bad ball hitter and a bad disposition. Joe, at that one year, I think it was 38 that he got to, he won the Triple Crown. I believe it was 38.
I want to say 37.
Oh, whatever year it was, anyway, whatever it was. I thought he was the best hitter I'd seen at that time. And he was they call him a bad ball hitter. He's liable to hit. I've seen him hit, swing and hit balls, but literally over his head or head high, or even almost bounce, you might say. But he when he made up his mind to swing the ball, he hit the ball. No matter where it was, he went after it and hit it with power. He was strong anyway. He was a strong Hungarian boy from New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And excuse me, I'm coughing a lot. But anyway, He was a real strong fellow, strong will, strong muscles, and strong head. And, he was that year. I thought he was one of the best hitters I've ever seen because a lot of hitters when they hit for big average. A lot of their hits are just kind of dribblers or something. I don't think I ever saw him just get a real easy hit. I think every ball it seemed like to me. When you think back of it, every ball he hit was a line drive. It would hit hard. And, well, I think he hit several home runs that year. I think he hit in the 40s, or 30, high 30s or 40s home runs that year. And I thought he was great. He was really, really great there. Of course, he had another guy hitting with him, too, that helped him a lot, too. Johnny Mize hit behind him. I think Johnny Mize was one of the prettiest hitters. He and Ted Williams were two of the prettiest hitters I've ever seen. They did everything right. I mean, what we say, Spalding guy. And everything he did, I thought Mize was a great hitter that year, too. Well, Mize was still great there, I mean, all the time.
Yeah.
Medwick fell off in about 2 years. His ability dwindled. He wasn't near the player.
Well, he was never the same after he was beamed.
In Boston. I mean, in Brooklyn, yeah. No, he never did. He never did come back after that. I don't know why. But I think that he was kind of started downhill before. I mean, I think he was getting over the hill a little bit then, and then that just kind of pushed him.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was good. He, Medwick really had a bad disposition.
Well, now, why was that?
Well, because he was just.
Just his
disposition.
Just his temperament.
I don't know, just his temperament, I guess. Well, I think he grew up in New Jersey, and I think he had kind of a rough childhood, probably. I mean, in a rough neighborhood, I put it that way. I don't know how else you put it. Kind of rough neighborhood. He just said, I've got to beat everything. I've got to do it myself. He doesn't depend on anybody else.
You were you didn't play in the 34 season,
no.
but you were on the team.
Yes, I was in 1934. I went to spring training with them, and the Cardinals sent me out to Houston, Texas, and then they recalled me the 1st of September to come back. But I was not eligible to play in the World Series.
Right.
And I saw them. I was there, but yeah. I didn't, and that was the year that. They came from behind, remember, they were 6 or 7 games back from the Giants.
Right.
And they started winning. I never will forget that because when we went up there, by the way, that Walter Alston and myself and another fellow named Pat Ankeman, the three of us was called up, but we weren't eligible for it. But so he said, now as soon as we decide who's going to win the pennant, if we're out of the pennant race or anything happens, we'll get you we want you to play. So, you just sit here and learn what you can and don't worry about not playing until the time comes. So we did. We'd sit there and watch them put back practice course and
we were a member of the club and all that. And so we came to the World Series, and they sent us, you know, we could Ellsworth on. But I wished I went up there.
If I'm not mistaken, Walter Austin had one at bat in the big leagues.
Let me tell you about
and
that.
And you saw it.
I was there. And Walt Austin, one time, he was called on to pinch hit. And so Frisch said to me, he said, get ready, because if he gets on first base, I want you to run for him. Boy, I was all primed to run. I was going to get in the big leagues. I'm going to be a big league ball player. And Walt Austin struck out, and I didn't get to run for him. So that was Walter's and my entrance to the big leagues.
Mm-hmm. Were you in Detroit for the seventh game of that 34 World Series?
No. I didn't go with that. No, I didn't. But it was, of course, I watched it on TV. It must have been quite a ball.
Mm-hmm.
And Medrick slid into. What game was that? That Medrick slid
into? That was the seventh game, I think. Is it Marvolin was?
Marvolin was their third baseman. He slid into. And Medrick slid in. Medrick always slid hard.
Yep.
He didn't do anything. He did than he ever did. Except that the situation was just kind of bad at that time. Yeah. You know what? He did that. He didn't. I don't think Medrick wanted to hurt somebody, but he slid in hard everywhere.
And of course, they got in the fight. And
and then he was Commissioner Landis asked him to please go to the dugout. Of course, I think at that time the Cardinals were ahead 5 or 6, 7 runs. I think getting later in the game.
Yeah, I remember. I think the game wound up 11-0. I think
it was.
Now, did you have any dealings in person, face-to-face with Landis?
No, I didn't. I'd seen him talk to him. I'd seen him at the ball game. But usually came out the ball game in Chicago when we went to play the Cubs. And I'd seen him, and that's all. I didn't have any. I never had any dealings with him or anything.
How about Burgess Whitehead?
Oh, little Burgess. Burgess was a second baseman. In fact, he was with the Cardinals before I came up there. But I knew him because we had been in spring training together.
Mm-hmm.
And Burgess, he was a little North Carolina boy that talked that North Carolina dialect. I loved him. He was a good second baseman.
He was Diz's. Didn't him and Diz pal around a lot together?
Oh, yeah. He and Diz were pals, yeah. Before Diz and him. In fact, he came up just right after Dizzy, I think, and that's the reason I think they kind of piled together. Dizzy loved him too. And he would throw at everybody, you know, if somebody get hit, he'd throw Dizzy throw at him. But he wouldn't throw it. He wouldn't throw it. Dizzy wouldn't throw it two different people. He wouldn't throw it Carl Hubbell or Burgess White.
Talking about when Burgess went over to the Giants.
After Burgess went to the Giants, yeah.
Dizzy wouldn't throw at any pitcher at all, would he?
I don't think that's wrong. I don't believe so. I think unless it would have been Carlton.
Tex Carlton.
He and Tex didn't get along. He might have given a little push. Dizzy didn't throw another pitcher. So
yeah.
But you talk about that fight that we got into. That Dizzy. By the way, I think I've been in about 4 or 5 fights with Dizzy, and he hasn't swung a ball or got hit yet, and I got hit in every damn one. he would start a fight, and then, of course, we didn't want him to get hurt because he was our meal ticket.
Right.
We'd shove him back out of the way, and then we'd take up the fight, and Dizzy would go unscratched and stand back and laugh. But anyway, this particular game that they were supposed to be the game of the century, Dizzy was supposed to pitch against Carl Hubbell. And, of course, that was the two biggest pitchers at that time. It was in St. Louis, and they really crowded in that day. And the old capacity crowd, of course. And let me go back just a tiny bit. Before that, they had complained about Dizzy not stopping with a runner on first base. And the rule says you have to hesitate at your belt. To give the base runner a chance, you know, the base runner couldn't never steal or couldn't have a chance if you do that. So they made this rule, and so Dizzy was, of course, I guess Dizzy went back to, he didn't have very many men on base anyway. he just didn't stop. And so this particular day, he was playing the Giants, and all along about third, fourth, sometime, the score was tied, I believe, and there was a runner on second base. And Dizzy looked back and didn't stop, and the batter hit the ball out the outfield and out, and of course, the runner would stay at second base. Well, they called a balk on him. Well, he got mad. And of course, he was going to sit down strike on the mound and everything. But then he got mad and he said, "Well, I'm just mad." So he started. Well, they sent the runner back to second base. To third base. The next guy up hit a fly ball and he scored. And I think I put him ahead 2-1 or 3-2 or something. Anyway, it was a close ball game. And so Dizzy said, after he got him back and got calmed down a little bit, then he started throwing at the giant hitters. And I'm dead, he threw at them. I'm dead, he really unloaded on some of them.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, I think they got a little mad. I don't see why they wouldn't. I would have too. But anyway, I believe, if I'm correct, Jimmy Ripple, the left-hand hitter, he was going to run the ball down towards first base. And when Dizzy covered first base, Johnny Myers was going to have to field the ball. And he was going to, Dizzy covered first base, he was going to slide into him or run up his legs and cut his legs off. I mean, that was the idea.
Mm-hmm.
We did things in that way. And so and he fouled the first one. Pulled a foul. Well, DeRocher was playing shortstop, and DeRocher always called me the kid. And so we knew exactly what was going to happen. So we did start winding up. He said, "Come on, kids, it's going to be trouble. Come on." So we, DeRocher and I, when he pitched the ball, we started for first base because we knew that we felt sure that's going to be. Well, we thought that we'd get in front of Diz and big Johnny Myers would get in front of Ripple and, you know, let them talk and, you know, how baseball departments are. Well, we didn't count on those other 24 players coming out of that dugout over there, giant dugout. They were come out of there fast as you could ever. They were shot out of there. And those Cardinals were clear across the base, clear across the diamond. They was on third base side. Boy, I thought they were the slowest getting over there. I ever saw. Anyway, DeRocher and I got in front of Diz and kind of hold. In fact, no matter, DeRocher and I kind of locked arms and pushed Diz. It was in front of Diz, pushing and trying to hold everybody back so they couldn't get to Diz. And somebody whacked me. I ate off. Lukey was the one that. Well, I found out later he was the one hitting me, but I didn't know that. But anyway, he whacked me and really blacked my eye. I said, I think that when he hit me, I think my head just stood still, my feet flew in the air, and I lit on my head. But anyway, everybody was white. I laughed at Mickey Owen later. He said, "I thought everybody was supposed to get their own dishes," so he hunted up Gus Mancuso and jumped on Gus Mancuso and got him down with pounding on him. He said everybody was for their own position.
Catcher for catcher, right?
And so it was a big to-do all over. And Pepper Martin come running in from the outfield. And he loved this. Loved his fighting anyway. And they said that he'd just grab a guy out of the crowd, you know, like it, and just jerk him and turn with cartwheel backwards. And now stay back there. And he had about five of them lined up in center field. When said, "You stay out of this fight," and so he didn't get another one. So we come in with they went to their dugout. We finally got in ours and calmed things down for a little bit. And Pepper come running over there and they saw me and I had this big black eye. He said, "What happened to you?" I said, "Well, some guy took a sneak punch at me." "Oh," he said, "them son of a gun." So he took out and ran right over, clear across the diamond to the dugout at first base. And challenged anybody. Said, "Whoever hit that kid, come out here. I want to get even with him. You're a coward and everything else hitting that kid." And so they challenged him. They finally got him back over there. But he went over, came over there by himself, challenged the whole. None of them came out of there either, I'll tell you that. But that was the fight of the century.
How about, is it Charlie Gilbert?
Yes, Charlie Gilbert. He was a shortstop and third baseman infielder when I came up there. The story I like telling for him, I came up there, and of course, he had been, the previous year, remember, he went to a hunting accident, and he shot his leg.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about.
Shot the muscle out of his lower leg.
Calf muscle.
And he, of course, he was around running again, but it slowed him up. He was really a good third baseman, too, I'll tell you. Well, anyway, he gave me his glove to play with, because my old glove. Going back to my old glove, I went up there and we were in Boston. We traveled at that time with trunks, and as soon as you get your have trays and trunks, and so they would. You put your uniform and everything in this little tray, and they put it in the trunk. They had trunks there, and then that's where, because we traveled by train, that's how they carried the uniforms. So they got a trunk laying there, and I came after the ball game. We used to leave the gloves out there, and so I remember I happened to be in Boston, and we were playing in Boston, and I happened to be on base when the game was over. We got beat, and Grace was mad. So we came in, and everybody brings their gloves, and, you know, kind of lays them on the trunk and pick them up and put them in the locker, but everybody kind of helps everybody else in. And my glove was laying there on the trunk. It was an old-looking, terrible-looking glove. So I think it came from Woolworth, I'm not sure. And anyway, he was raving. He was walking. He was all in their lockers, waiting for him to give us the devil. He was really eating this out and telling us all about Sunday school classes and some of our relatives and one thing or another. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so he saw this glove, and I said, "Who the hell glove is that thing?" And he picked up that glove and gave it a flip, and went right out the window. It went right out the window, the clubhouse window, and there were some kids playing out there on the street, and they didn't even pick up the glove. You know how bad the glove was, don't you? So I got the clubhouse boy. I sneaked. I said, "Go get that, my glove. Go get it." So the clubhouse boy got my glove. And so the next morning, the Kenmore Hotel, and the phone rang and said, "Frankie Frisch said, I want you to come up here and I want to talk to you." Boy, I thought I was a rookie. Manager calling up his hotel room. "You thought you was ready to go." Boy, he did. He gave me a lecture about, if you're in the big leagues now, you've got to have big league tools. He said, "A good carpenter has a good hammer, and a good saw." So he said, "Get yourself some good tools." And so he opened up his trunk, and he opened up and he gave me a brand new glove. At that time, he had signed with Spalding, one of those old Spalding gloves. That's what he used to use all. He said, "Here's a new glove. You break this glove in, and you get that. Now on, you play with good tools." So I took it out. Of course, I was scared to death, but I was tickled to death to get a glove, too. And Charlie Gilbert, that day, he said, "Here, you take my glove," because he wasn't playing too much. And he said, "You take my glove, and let me break yours in a little bit, and I'll work with you." So he did. Thing was, too, I was taking his place. You know, mm-hmm. I was going to replace him. And so I thought that was very nice. He always was nice to me.
Yeah. I'm under the impression, anyway, that he kind of knew after the hunting accident that his days were numbered.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, he did. He knew that he couldn't move like he used to. He was a good shortstop, and he could move laterally. But after that, he couldn't. He knew it, but then he came back to try. Of course, who wouldn't?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got a little bit of time left on this side. I want to ask you about Ernie Orsatti. In hanging around, he used to hang around Buster Keaton's movie lot.
He was there in 34, and I knew him, but I didn't know him, Ernie, that bad.
Mm-hmm.
But he used to call him Buster Keaton, I mean, mm-hmm. literally. And he used to hang around in his lot. And finally, I think Ernie Orsatti's brother was kind of a producer, or anyway, he sold movies. I think he was the agent for sell music, and Ernie did that. He helped him after Ernie got out of baseball. He went there, and he also acted. He did a little acting too, but that's what Ernie really did. He helped his brother. I mean, he and his brother went and did us about selling movies, I think, distributing it, I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Did you, from playing baseball, did you get to meet any Hollywood types, any stars or anything?
I met George Raff because of
Leo.
We met several of those, movie stars would come and live for a little while, but not anything. There was one guy that used to, he was a comedian, on the stage comedian, Perkins. I'm trying to think of his name. But he was a big, fat guy, and he loved the Cardinals, and he used to follow, he used to go on train with us, he used to go road trip with us. And he was a fun guy, Perkins. I can't think of his first name, but he traveled with us. He was our chief star, I think. Just claim the frame.
Well, you talked about a little bit about George Raff, so that's what I want to ask you about Leo now. Who was the worst bench jockey you ever heard? Was it Leo or?
Probably Leo. He was. Boy, he had a quick tongue. He had a fork of tongue. Gilmore said, and he really is. He could really get on, and he loved to do it too. His mind was. He said some nasty things to these people. I couldn't even think of them. He could say them to them. He was a bench jockey. He wanted everybody else to be a bench jockey too. And he was Zero Osher. I want to tell you another story about Zero Osher. Well, Zero Osher and Medley, because they were buddies. And they Zero Osher got Medley to dress up. Zero Osher was a fashion plate.
Yeah.
Well, Medley wanted to be a fashion plate too, because he and Zero Osher were buddies. They roomed together and they were together. But during the A lot of ball players didn't like Zero Osher and Medley. I mean, they just didn't have the personalities. Nothing wrong with your personality. It's your personality, And they didn't like. But I always liked Zero Osher. And of course, he played shortstop, and when I played third base, he was playing short, and he helped me out too because he knew the players. He knew, and he moved me around. He helped me. And I appreciated that. And so, when it came to the 1944 World Series, he was, at that time, Zero Osher, I think, was still in the National League. He might have been with the Giants or something. I don't know who he was with at that time. But anyway, I was on the American League side, and Zero Osher and Medley, both of them were sitting over on the National League side. And they got up from there, I think, before the game, and came back around and called me out of the dugout and congratulated me and said, wish me luck and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only two National League players that ever said anything to me, although I played 4 years in the National League. And they came over there just specifically to tell me, and I thought that was one of the nicest things I ever really did. I really appreciate that, too. Another time Dave Osher helped me out, I think, was we were playing in Chicago, and Frank Demery was the hitter, and Dizzy Dean was the pitcher. And Dizzy liked to get the ball and throw it, He'd get the ball to Dizzy. He wanted to get rid of it. He didn't take much time out there. So, of course, we'd toss around, ball around the infield, and I was up close to Dizzy, and tossing the ball, and I started back towards third base. And I just got back to third base. I just started to turn around, and boom, a ball went right by my ear. And boy, I tell you, a little more had gotten. And I just to turn around enough to get out of the way of it. I came in, a Frisch met me about halfway, and he just gave me hell for not being ready to play. And Zero Osher said, hey, that big dumb guy out there on the mound called that. He said, he didn't give us a chance to get back there. I said, I wasn't back either. He said, don't get on that kid, for God. I'll get on that guy that you ought to get on. So he protected me. So I remember those things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about Leo and George Raft. I know he got in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I think that was the time he got in trouble, really, was in, when he was at Brooklyn, not with the Cardinals. But of course, George had come. We'd seen George. He was with George every time. But what he did, what happened, that he and George Raft were buddies, and they went out together, and, you know, after the war, and they thought that George Raft was connected with the mafia. And so they, was it Chandler?
Yeah, Happy Chandler.
Happy Chandler told him if he didn't stop, he's going to, because the idea of gambling came up, and with the mafia. And he said if you didn't stop, that they were going to suspend him. And he finally did, because the realtor didn't, you know, saw him, and then he was his friend, so, you know, why he didn't see a reason why he couldn't associate with his friend.
Frankie Frisch, how about, first of all, what did you think of him as a manager, first of all?
I thought Frankie Frisch was a good manager. But, you know, he had one of the toughest clubs in the world to manage. Mm-hmm. When you try to manage guys like Leo DeRocher, Joe Medwick, Pepper Martin, Dizzy Dean, mm-hmm. Paul Dean, Bill DeLancey, you know, how can you don't manage those guys. I mean, but I thought he was a good manager, and I thought, you know, he was good. Because he kept them pretty well in line. I thought he did a good job, and he knew baseball. Frankie knew baseball. He was a good, solid manager. Of course, he was a little fiery, too, and that didn't help any, because he'd get on these guys and eat them up, too. And you might as well, like, pouring water off the duck's mouth. When you got after them, you know, they'd go, what the hell, you know.
Yeah.
And then when we get one time, going back to Pepper, we hadn't been going too good. You know, we'd lost a few games. We was kind of a slump like. And Chris was really, even at that one meeting before the game, he had a meeting, and boy, he was telling us a few things about our relatives and so forth. And finally, Pepper said, hey, Frankie, put up his hand like a little boy in school. He said, what do you want, Johnny? Pepper Martin, Johnny. And he said, you know, Frankie, said, you know, you can't win the Kentucky Derby with a mule. He said, we've got a lot of asses around here. We're gonna. So the meeting broke up right there.
Over. What was Frisch's problem with umpires? I guess he used to argue with them and bait them.
That's right. He and Casey were the two of them that loved to bait umpires. I think that was part of his repertoire, is to get holler with the umpire in order to get his ball players riled up a little bit too. I think that was his strategy. And he argued with the umpires. He would just argue like the devil. I remember one time, one of the umpires, it might have been Bill Clem, I'm not sure, one of the umpires, and Frisch got into it. And so Bill Clem drew a line with his foot. He said, if you come across that line, you're out of the ball game. And so Frisch went right up to the line like this, and he said, you're across it. He said, no, he said, this is your line over here. And they got drawn lines, which one was the line, and argued about which line was which was going to throw him out of the ball game. But that, things like that, he argued like that all the time. He loved, Frisch loved controversy. You know, some people do.
Yeah.
And I think he's one of them that really enjoyed having controversy.
You mentioned Bill DeLancey, and I know that he had, I guess he played in the 34 season.
Yes.
And then had some had some physical problems.
Yes,
he had
lung removed. He had TB.
Yeah.
And I think during the next season, during the next winter, he had to have one lung taken out. And it hurt. And he tried to come back and play. I think he came back and played a year, but not
1940. I think he played part of the year.
I know he came back and tried to play, but he just
How good was he? Because I know in Ricky's book that came out in 1965 called The American Diamond, he picks his favorite players, yeah. And he picked three catchers. One of the three catchers he picked was Bill DeLancey.
Yeah, he was a young guy, you know, at that time, just really coming into his own. He could hit. He was a big, strong hitter, and he could throw. And he was going to be a great, great catcher. And then this thing hit him, and of course, it sent him downhill. And I think you're right. I think Ricky was, but I thought Bill was really a. I was only played the first one I saw Bill. He was in spring training. I mean, I was in spring training with him, and I thought he was a great catcher. I really did. But then afterwards, when he couldn't produce like that. I mean, because when you play in the big leagues, you can't have very many things wrong with him and produce. You know, I thought he was a great catcher.
Did you do any running around off the field with Ripper Collins?
No, I didn't. I didn't. But Rip, I played that one year when the first year I came up. He was there, and Rip was kind of the mastermind behind a lot of Pepper's silliness, because he had put this idea in Pepper Martin's head, and Pepper Martin would do it, and then Rip would sit back and laugh like the devil, because Rick was home free. He didn't do anything. You know. But he agitated Martin a lot. I didn't associate with him too much. Because when I first came up, Terry Moore and Jimmy Brown, we were all rookies, and Johnny Mines, we were kind of the rookie crowd. Mm-hmm. And so we stayed with the rookie group, and we didn't really get outside of Pepper. But Pepper played with all groups. He didn't care what he did.
How about the guy that was at the end of his career was with the Cardinals when you came up, Jesse Haynes?
Jesse Haynes, yeah, he was a first-class man. He was an A1 man. He really was. I thought an awful lot of him. He was, of course, that was the end of his, towards the end of his career. Well, in fact, that was the end of his career. And I really admired him. He was one of those guys that I would just kind of be around and talk to and kind of awe, you know, like a little kid kind of with his mouth gapping open. And he was a fine man. I couldn't say anything wrong. I didn't see anything he ever did wrong. It's a shame that I wish that I could have played with him when he was back in his prime. Because mm-hmm. This was his time. The last 2 years, he used a knuckleball more than he did fastball, because he lost his fastball. Yeah. But Jesse was, I just can't say enough nice things about him. He was kind of like my dad, you know.
Mm-hmm. Of all these guys that you played with, be it Diz or Jesse Haynes or Medwick or Mize or any of these guys, any guys that eventually wound up in the Hall of Fame, did you ever head back to Cooperstown, any of the induction ceremonies for any of the guys that you played with?
No. The only time I went back there for the inductions was when Al Lopez, because I was Al Lopez's coach for 16 years. Mm-hmm. And when Al went back in the Hall of Fame, I went back for Al. But the other times I have been to the Hall of Fame is when, you know, every year they have two teams, one from the American League, one in play. And two different years, one time with the Cardinals and one time, I think, with the Red Sox, with the White Sox, we went back to play, and I saw them. You know, I mean, I watched all the proceedings.
Right.
And, I played with a lot of Hall of Fame players. They said, "Are you in the Hall of Fame?" I said, "No, but I put a lot of pictures in the Hall of Fame." Yeah. No, I really did play with a lot of Hall of Famers: Ted Williams, Bobby Doerr, of course, Dizzy, and Medrick, Mize. You know, a lot of those fellas I played with or against, way back even Bill Terry, those fellas like that.
Yeah.
I played against Mellott. I played against him, and I really, Casey Stengel, of course, I knew Casey. And I said I really admired him, and I think that That's great. Casey, I knew Casey fairly well because Al Lopez and he were great friends. Of course, Al played for him, and they were. And we'd go to Brooklyn or where Casey was, or Casey come there, and Al, we'd all kind of go out to dinner, and Al would ask Casey, he wouldn't come, you know, to it. So I got to hear. I didn't talk to Casey. I listened to Casey. But I really admired him too. He's a very, Casey is really a smart baseball man. And so is Al Lopez too. Al, I was Al was manager and I was his coach in Indianapolis before he went to Cleveland. And then he went to Cleveland and then he came over to the White Sox and I was at the White Sox. And I stayed as his coach. I was his coach in Indianapolis and I became his coach again in Chicago. I was with him. I was with him altogether about 14, 15 years. And I admired Al. I think Al was one of the smartest pitching coaches, mm-hmm. and manage the pitching staff than anybody I ever seen. I thought Al always was always one or two plays ahead of the game. I mean, he knew what he was going to do as manager, what he was going to call for as manager, two plays before it happened. And I think Al was one of the great managers of all time. I really do. He had some bad luck. He didn't win World Series and all that. Never, but still don't keep me thinking he's great.
Mm-hmm. Now you had speaking of Casey, your cousin Ray Mueller played for Casey back in '38, I think.
I think he did. Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He played for. I think in the old when Casey was managing the old Boston Bees, Braves or Bees,
whatever they're called.
Yeah, my cousin played for him. He'd tell me about Casey too, of course. He loved Casey too. Everybody likes Casey.
Your cousin set a record. I think it was, I want to say 1944. Caught all 155 games.
No, he caught 233 consecutive games.
Right, consecutive. But in that one season,
every game in that season.
That's just amazing.
Well, that's amazing. A catcher, you know, with his
day baseball.
Yeah, with his beating, he takes back there and his fingers and getting hit and all that sort of stuff.
Doubleheaders.
Besides having to catch every ball that's pitched, you know.
Yeah.
Being able to catch them. So I think it's an amazing, amazing thing that he caught so many ball games in a row.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead and describe your cousin. I don't know if mentioned his name, Ray Mueller.
Yeah, Ray Mueller, yes. Ray Mueller, he and I, because we grew up together right here in Pittsburgh, and his mother and my mother were sisters. And so we played high school together. We were the same age. We played on Little League, because they didn't have Little League then, but we played on the town team, and then we played on the teams around here, the league teams, the city leagues and things around here. And then he went to, he got a chance to go to New York Penn League, and I got a chance to go to Lincoln, Nebraska. And we separated. We had never played any kind of game against each other. We played basketball together. We played baseball together. We played never played anything against each other until we went and I met him in the big leagues. He played with Boston and I played with the Cardinals. That's the first time we'd ever played against one another. And he was a good catch. He liked a little the hitting ability, but he was a fine catcher. I mean, receiver and thrower. And that kept him in the big leagues because he was a good receiver and a good thrower. He was a sturdy guy. Like you said, he caught 233 games. So, by the way, too, he just recently died.
Yeah. I think it was June of last year.
Yeah, something.
Did he talk much to you when you come up to the plate to bat?
Oh, not very much.
Huh?
No, he'd kid me a little bit one thing about, you know, good throw you a curveball or something like that, you know. But the conversation wasn't much, because both of us were so intent.
Mm-hmm.
When I got up to bat, I was intent. There was only one other guy in the world, and that was that pitcher out there. The rest of the world was nowhere when I went up to bat, because I needed all the concentration I could get to get be a hitter. And he couldn't distract him. The only one that distracted me in the mountain was Yogi. Yogi used to throw dirt on your feet. just about the time your pitcher would get ready to pitch, he'd have a little temper, and he'd just kind of throw that dirt on your feet. Of course, you'd shake a little bit, and have the ball. But he was the only one really that did much talking. Big Al Todd used to once in a while.
Yeah.
Remember Al Todd? He was with Pittsburgh and Philadelphia.
Yeah.
He used to talk all the time when he tried to distract you. Mm. Concentration.
I'll just finish up with the Cardinals. I want to talk about the Dean boys. What did you and the rest of the team think of Dizzy with his? With the constant headaches that he gave the management and the team, and his holdouts, and his crying wolf about his sore arm and stuff. I mean, did you guys just blow it off?
Yeah, we got to know Dizzy Dean, and you just got to accept Dizzy Dean as Dizzy Dean. And it didn't bother us what he said to the manager, I mean, the front office or manager or anything. I mean, we just took it as well. There's Dizzy. So what difference? We went ahead and played our game, and we knew that when Dizzy Dean walked out on that mound, that he was going to win. I mean, his idea was win. From then on, all the foolishness was gone. And Dizzy didn't make many mistakes on that mound, and all this outside stuff, we accepted it. Well, Dizzy, let reporters talk to Dizzy. We'll just go our own way. No, the players themselves didn't. The players didn't all like this,
yeah.
Because he would do anything for you. I mean, Dizzy was great. I mean, in the mound, I mean, just player to player. And there wasn't nobody that didn't like Dizzy. You know, I mean, they liked him because he was fun, and, you know, and then also they liked him because he was competitive.
Yeah.
And that when you're talking about playing Major League Baseball, you got to talk about competition. That's another thing too. But they said who was a great player. There's three players I think that I noticed that, I mean, that to me shows great, great respect. That is, any time that Ted Williams, Mickey Mantle, or Joe DiMaggio in the batting box, you know, you would come in batting practice before games, something like that. And the other side would be warming up, you know, playing catch one thing or another. If you look at, they all quit. And when those three, anytime they get in the batter's box, everybody stopped, the players themselves on the opposing club stopped and watched. And I think that showed me the best, biggest respect of any of them. Because who else would do that when your own peers will stop what they're doing to watch you? I think that's an ultimate respect.
Mm-hmm. And Paul then was the exact opposite.
Yes.
Of Dizzy.
Oh yeah.
Shy.
Yeah. Shy. Paul was kind of the I think kind of like the little dog type that run along after the master.
Mm-hmm.
Dizzy, Paul would follow Dizzy, and Dizzy thought Paul was Paul thought Dizzy was the greatest guy in the world, and he laughed at everything. Dizzy could fall off a log, and Dizzy Paul would laugh at him because Paul just idolized this. And he tried to do everything like this, except Paul was very shy. Paul did not pop off the media or anything unless Dizzy brought him in and made him talk. Another thing, too, I think hurt Paul probably. I mean, I say Paul was like that a little bit because, see, Paul couldn't read and write when he first came up. And they said, this is a story that I'm sure is true, but that Dizzy's wife taught Paul to read and write. And I know that when Paul's roommate, Paul had a girlfriend that he finally married down in Arkansas, and when she'd write him a letter, he would get one of his roommates to read it to him, and then he'd get his roommate to write back to him. And that's one of the things he taught himself and Pat Dean did it. Why?
Mm-hmm.
Taught him to read and write.
And I guess what little I read about this is a father anyway, that he wasn't the greatest role model in the world.
No, he wasn't. No, they tell some wild tales, don't they? Mm-hmm. I just read some of them. Of course, I didn't ask Dizzy if they were true, but Dizzy would probably say, yeah, they were. I remember one time he was during spring training, and some he was writing a big article about his, and they said, where were you born? He said, somewhere in Russellville, Arkansas. And about 5 minutes later, somebody else came along and said, where were you born? He said, I don't know, I was born some other place. They wound up the same day. He gave 3 different interviews and born, raised here. Well, they all need the scoop. So that was Dizzy. That typified Dizzy. He wanted everybody to have a scoop.
What a character. Yes, what did Paul think of Dizzy's antics? Or you just
Paul thought they were great. Yeah. Oh yeah, Paul was great. He followed, like I said, he thought everything Dizzy done was great. He enjoyed every bit of it. He was Dizzy's laughing boy. He just laughed at everything Dizzy did.
You played a little bit with Slaughter when he first came up.
Yes, yes.
And how about Terry Moore? Did you also play with him?
Yes, not? Terry. Terry and I came up. Well, Terry came up just about 6 months before I did. I mean, mm-hmm. Terry was there when I got there, but he had just got there. Mm-hmm. And Marty Marion came up. Mm-hmm. When I was there. And also, I think 39 was Slaughter's first year.
And
Terry Moore, Terry and I and Johnny Mize were probably buddies. I mean, we were the three. We stuck together a whole lot. I mean, we went to shows after the game and, you know, knew each other and the families knew each other. And of course, Terry wasn't married at that time. Huh. He didn't get married later. But we ate together. We went to shows together. And Slaughter was in 39, and he kind of joined us too. But at that time, you know, rookies kind of stayed with rookies, and it was kind of a little, well, there wasn't a click, and they were good to us. I mean, Dizzy and Paul and Pepper was good to us. I mean, he's the rookie. He made sure that he took the rookies out to dinner a time or two when they first got there. Everyone come on, they always brought him out and said, hey, you're a member now, you're a big leaguer now, mm-hmm. act like a big leaguer, you know. They kind of father us a little bit. And that's the way they did then. I don't know if they still did or not. But.
Well, the reason I brought up Slaughter and Moore is because in 47, I think those are the two that tried to get the Cardinals to go on strike instead of having to play the Brooklyn Dodgers because of Jackie Robinson.
Well, was that right? I don't know about.
I was going to ask you, from what you knew about those two guys anyway, if that surprised you. Or
yeah, if that is true, that really surprised me. And not so much as Slaughter, but Terry. Slaughter, of course, came from North Carolina. Terry originally came from Alabama, too. And I think that, going back to that, I suspect that might have been, I don't know. Yeah. But I don't know anything about that. I mean, when Jackie Robinson came up, there was a lot of different clubs, you know, Southern boys. They didn't want to play against him. And there was Jackie Robinson took a lot of abuse. And he had to be a special kind of a guy in order to take that kind of abuse and still produce. Mm-hmm. I really do. I think he didn't, just personally, it didn't bother me because through here, I went to school with colored people. It was colored kids in our class in high school. So, I mean, to me, that was nothing. I mean, that was just natural. The color didn't make any difference to me. But when I went up there, when he came in, then I saw a lot of animosity. And I think it's because, well, the times, you know, it just, we were still fighting the Civil War. I think Jackie Robinson, no other colored person I never know of could have done the job he done under the circumstances he did. Campanella came close to him. I didn't know Jackie Robinson very well. He was in the other league when I was American League. But of course, I knew the situation. And I think he was had a little animosity all the time towards somebody. I think he was he thought the world kind of against him. He would fight back all the time. Where Campanella was more the silent type, more the quiet type guy that just live and let live. And they didn't like him or was already with him. He liked them, so he just it was different in personalities. Of course, I don't mean to say that Campanella wasn't proud that he was a colored fellow. Well, I didn't mean that at all, because he was, but he didn't let it really get the best of him.
By the time you'd come up to the Cardinals for good in 36, was Paul's arm already gone?
Paul no, didn't? The next year he came. I think the year that I came up there, Paul could still throw pretty good. Mm-hmm. But I think the next year, I think in 37 was his year that the arm really went bad. Wasn't it? I think that's right. No, Paul, I saw Paul pitch some pretty good ball games. Yeah.